we're going to do a show, so gather round, folks, and let yourselves go. God bless you, madam. God bless you. Thank you very much indeed.
A camera crew on location by the muddy bank of a disused canal. From his hovel emerges Sam, the old music hall star who earns his living as a busker, ready to face the world. The optimists, who overcame their financial disaster, are back on the road again. Their star, Peter Sellers, has signed up at last. Today, it seems that there's no business like show business.
Here, take some. Get here, chip. Donna.
It's a picnic, mister.
Aye.
Cheers on a picnic's got to be in the country.
Oh, aye. Who told you that?
Our dad.
Did he?
Yeah. Picnic's got to have flowers and grass.
Oh. What else did he say, your dad? Tell an apple from an onion because he's always crying. A picnic's where you're enjoying it. You enjoying it? Right, then it's a picnic. A picnic's a flaming picnic.
Snot.
That's a rude word. Use your handkerchief. Coughs and sneezes spread diseases. Even walls have ears. Charming manner she's got, like that fella lived next door. Spent all day teaching himself how to be a brass band. Funny thing, he'd play the fiddle.
To Goonpod, and this week we're looking at a film from the 70s about a man in his 60s, played by a chap in his 40s, who paid scant heed to the old showbiz maxim, never work with children or animals. But before we get to that, let me introduce this week's guest. It's writer, performer, presenter, Bob Fisher.
Hello.
Hello, Bob.
How are you?
Not too bad.
Excellent. Good to hear. And before you ask, I'm in rude health.
You're in rude health. Good. I think it's...
Well, probably just rude, actually.
I think we're enjoying the last sunny day of 2023 today.
You say that. Whereabouts are you where it's particularly sunny on this... I was going to say this August afternoon, but it's not August, it's September.
Yeah. I'm in the tropical north of England.
Are you?
In Lyme. In Cheshire.
In Lyme, in Cheshire. Mm. Once the home of Matthew Corbett, I seem to recall.
Yes, I used to wave at him down the canal. I did.
He didn't have sooty on his hand, did he, as he waved back? Sorry if I've ruined the illusion for anybody there.
No, and I used to, get this, I used to knock into Ian Brown in Sainsbury's frequently.
Now, did you ever see Matthew Corbett and Ian Brown together?
No.
Oh, what a shame.
Could it be the same man?
Well, it could be the same man. Or maybe Ian Brown is just one of Matthew Corbett's coterie of strange characters and sidekicks. Who knows?
Who knows?
I'd like to see a version of the Stone Roses with Sweep on guitar. That would be great.
Yeah, you'd only see him from the waist up, though, wouldn't you?
That's true. There is... Did the kind of sooty team occasionally have a band that they performed?
Probably.
I've got a feeling they did. I'm sure I've seen Sweep on drums in one program or another.
That would make sense, yeah.
He feels like he should be a drummer, shouldn't he? He's got the wild side. Sorry, I can't help but feel we've drifted off track a little bit here already.
Yes, yes. Well, that's what this podcast is about. So what have you been up to?
Oh, really? Recently? Me? Mm. I write a lot for magazines. So my currently offering me an honest wage are magazines like the 40 and Times, which is the world's weirdest news, I think, is their strapline. And I've written for the 40 and Times for a lot of years now. So I kind of do... I guess I do their pop culture coverage. I do lots of music reviews for the 40 and Times. And I write for a magazine called Electronic Sound, which I've just completed a huge cover feature for Electronic Sound magazine. And such is the nature of publishing. I can't say who it's about, but it is... It is somebody that I love and whose music has soundtracked huge tracts of my life. So there you go. Those who know the kind of things that I like can try and piece together the clues. Okay. But it was a joy to work on, and that will be... I guess by the time this is broadcast, it might be close to being out there. It'll be for the October issue, I think. So that's Brilliant. Taken up a lot of my time recently, but it's been a joy.
And I I noticed on the... Again, I'm still calling it Twitter. On the Twitter.
Yes, I know.
That you're doing a Haunted Generation night.
Oh, I am. Well, yes. It's basically, it's me in the back room of a vegetarian restaurant on Teesside, where I live. And yeah, the Haunted Generation is a thing I've written about a lot. I'm terrible with titles, and it's possibly the only decent title I've ever come up with in my life. But in 2017, I wrote a feature for the 14 Times called The Haunted Generation. And it was basically about how... I guess how the popular culture of the 70s in particular had left a very profound effect on the kids that grew up during that era. And, you know, there are lots of very familiar programmes that seem to feed into these feelings. So shows like Children of the Stones and Wurzel Gummidge and, you know, more adult shows like Pender's Fen, Stone Tape, all of those wonderfully strange 70s TV programmes that fed into this very... unsettling childhood lots of us seem to enjoy. And I, yeah. You know, and I absolutely use the word enjoy. I did enjoy this stuff. But it's left a lingering effect on that generation. So the original Haunted Generation feature was very much about all of that and about the music and art and literature that those feelings are now inspiring. And it's kind of spiraled out of control for me, and it's become the main thing that I write about. It's still an ongoing column in the 14 Times. And yeah, I'm going to do a night at the Waiting Room in Eaglescliffe, which is quite... It'd be some personal stuff for me, I think. It'll be memorable. Of my own 1970s childhood, and God help everybody that turns up, possibly a bit of poetry and a couple of songs as well.
Brilliant. Okay.
There we go.
Brilliant.
We'll see how it goes, eh?
Brilliant. Okay. And so today, Bob, you because last time you came on to talk about a Peter Sellers' film, which never really saw the light of day, The Blockhouse.
Yes.
This one at least did, the one we're talking about today.
Yes.
And if you listen to this episode on the day it goes out, which is the 18th of October 2023, then it is exactly 50 years to the day that The Optimists of Nine Elms was released in the
is
cinemas.
Is that right? You,
yes.
You don't just throw these things together, do you?
No.
I had no idea about that, but that's wonderful.
Yes.
So it is the 50th anniversary of The Optimists of Nine Elms.
Indeed.
Right?
Indeed. And it's a film that, let me ask you, what's your history with this film?
Like many of Peter Sellers' films, it's one of those that I'd never heard of until I read Roger Lewis's doorstep-sized biography, The Life and Death of Peter Sellers. And as soon as I read about it, I knew that it was a film that I really wanted to see. But, I guess it's an ongoing story, and I'm sure you hear this a lot. Back in the 1990s when that book came out, not an awful lot of Peter Sellers' body of work was available to watch. So I think I have vague attempts I made back in the 1990s to track down a video of The Optimists of Nine Elms. I'm not sure if it ever got released on VHS in the UK. There was possibly an American release that was quite hard to get hold of, and I didn't have a video player that could play American tapes anyway. So I don't think I actually saw The Optimists of Nine Elms until possibly... I would say it's less than a decade ago, I would say, and I finally managed to get hold of an American Region 1 DVD and watch that. But it's one of those films, isn't it, from that particular part of Peter Sellers' working life drifted. So it wasn't repeated on TV particularly often, I don't think. It wasn't readily available. But it's a little gem, I think.
Yeah, it was from his right smack bang in the middle of his wilderness period, as I call it.
Yeah.
Because you've got the period from 1970 to about 1975. So, because, 1970, There's a Girl in My Suit did very well commercially.
Yeah.
Okay. Every film after that, up until Return of the Pink Panther, more or less, if it didn't stiff, it just didn't really do business, or it wasn't released.
Or it didn't get released at all, yeah.
Yeah. And there's, I would probably say this film of the, I don't know what it is, five, six films, seven films in that period, this is probably the strongest of those. I'm actually very fond of The Blockhouse that we discussed. And I'm in a weird way, I'm very fond of Ghost in the Noonday Sun as well.
Okay.
But I'm certainly not fond of Where Does It Hurt, which we'll be covering next year.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. I think similar to Hoffman, because I saw this when I was much younger. I think I taped it off the telly, and similar to Hoffman, I watched it the once and then never revisited it.
Okay.
And it's only been in recent years that I've watched it again and really, because you watched it through adult eyes.
Yeah.
And appreciated it for what it is. And it is, you know, it's not my favorite Sellers film by any stretch, but it's a wonderful performance. And
it is.
He's got, I mean, I said, I was joking, you know, I said before about never work with children or animals. The children and the animals in this are superb.
Yes.
I think. So I'll just do a little bit of background. Well, before I do that, actually, because I always do this, Bob, now. I don't know if we did it last time you were here. I always try to add a little bit of historical context to everything we're talking about. So, you know, when a film, if we're talking about a film or a book or a TV show or even a goon show, I talk about what was happening in the world that might interest my listeners on that day or around that time. Okay. The day after this was released was the final appearance of Ziggy Stardust.
Oh, is that right, at the Hammersmith Odeon?
Well, that was in July. That was the official last appearance. But Bowie played the Marquee Club in Soho.
Right.
On the 19th of October, 73. And it was specifically for an American television special.
Okay.
And I think it was just like, you know, invited audience only sort of thing. And it was only a small venue, and he came on stage as Ziggy one last time, and that was it.
Well, there we go.
You a Bowie fan?
I am a Bowie fan, absolutely. Yeah, so that's a little historical moment. I'm also a fan of Middlesbrough Football Club, so I can tell you that in October 1973, we're 2 months into Jack Charlton's extraordinary season as manager, his debut season as Borough manager, which led to Middlesbrough being promoted from the old second division as champions.
Brilliant.
So there you go.
Good.
There was a period in my life when I probably could have told you off the top of my head who Middlesbrough had played around the 18th of October 1973 and what the score was and who the scorers were. And probably had a decent stab at the attendance as well. But those days are long gone. Let's just say, if I say that John Hickton scored, that's probably right, because he usually did.
Right, okay. Because we were talking about music before, the 18th of October was a Thursday. I had a quick shifty at who was on Top of the Pops that night.
Oh, go on. Can I have a guess?
Yeah, so do you want to have a go at who's the presenter?
Oh, who's the presenter in 1973? Is it too early for Noel Edmonds?
I think.
Tony Blackburn.
Correct.
Yes! All right, so October 1973. Right, I'm going to have a stab at Slade?
No.
Mud?
Yes.
Mud, we're on it. Fantastic.
Mud on it, singing.
Fisher Strikes.
Dynamite.
Were they? Right, okay. Who else in the charts in late 1973? I don't know. Go on, tell me.
So we've got the Isley Brothers.
All right, yeah.
With That Lady. Is that the one that goes, "Who's that lady?" Is that one?
That's good enough for me.
Mm. There was a video of Bob Dylan singing Knocking on Heaven's Door.
Right, okay.
Peters and Lee, By Your Side.
Oh, not Welcome Home. Okay, that's a shame. I like Welcome Home.
Okay. Brian Ferry's debut. A Hard Rain's Gonna
and
Fall.
And it's a hard. Etc.
Yeah, well done.
Thank you.
Elton John, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Of course, classic.
Oh, The Mighty Nazareth.
Oh, a Nazareth on. Fantastic. Bad Boy.
This Flight Tonight.
This Flight Tonight, right, okay.
The Quo, of course.
The Mighty Quo, I think you'll find, to give them their full title.
Caroline.
Right. Oh, yeah. Classic. Great.
David Cassidy.
Oh, which David Cassidy song would that have been? No, I don't know. Go on, tell me.
It was a video. He wasn't performing live. It was Daydreamer.
Okay, yeah, lovely.
And then we got the Detroit Spinners.
The Destroyed Spinners. Wow, that was them towards the end of their careers.
Ghetto Child. But okay. What was number one that week?
Number one in October 1973. Oh, no, I don't know. You'll have to tell me.
It was Eye Level by the Simon Park Orchestra.
The Simon Park Orchestra, the theme to Van der Valk.
Yes.
Fantastic. With on the B-side, Distant Hills, the theme from Crown Court.
Really? Is that what that's called?
Absolutely, yeah.
I can't imagine that being, because I know I can think of the music in my head. I can't imagine that being strung out for 3 minutes, really.
Ah, now, well, are you thinking of, because Crown Court was one of those rare television series that had a different theme at the beginning and the end.
Oh, so yes.
The opening theme to Crown Court goes...
Yes, it does.
And I've no idea what it's called. But Distant Hills is the kind of plaintive music that plays over the end as the defendant is being carted away. There we go.
Mums across the land would have bought that single, wouldn't they?
Well, not just mums. I definitely own a copy of that 7-inch. I did actually spot, it's not that many years ago, I was watching an episode of, I think it was Bargain Hunt. It was one of the antiques programmes on BBC One. Yeah. And Simon Park popped up as a contestant, just as an ordinary member of the public in his civvies. But when he was pressed as to what he'd done for a living, he had to admit he'd been a professional musician. It emerged that he was Simon Park.
Was that Eye Level his the apogee of his career?
I think it was, wasn't it? Well, he didn't have another number one, that's for certain. I love the footage of Eye Level on it's probably on that very edition of Top of the Pops, when I think the entire Simon Park Orchestra actually turns up in the studio and he's decked them all out in absolutely wonderful mustard coloured polo necks.
Mm.
The whole lot of them. He must have got a job lot of mustard-coloured polo necks off the back of a lorry sometime in 1973. Mm. But they look great. It's a much neglected colour in the fashion world, I find, these days. Mustard.
You say 1973 to someone, the first thing you think of is mustard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there we go. Oh, well, wonderful. Thank you for that context.
There we go. So that sort of eases us into the film. Now, the film...
Yes.
Written by Anthony Simmons.
Yes.
Based on his novel from 1964, or novella, which I've read. Have you?
I have not read the novella, I must admit.
You've not prepared.
I haven't. I watched the film.
Well,
blood?
It's only about 50 pages long. It's hardly,
right, okay.
It's barely a pamphlet. but it's very faithful. The film's very faithful to the novel, or the novella.
Okay.
But it's written by him, and also Tudor Gates. Now then, do you know Tudor Gates?
Tell me about Tudor Gates. I know a bit about Tony Simmons, funnily enough, but much less about Tudor Gates.
We'll come back to Tony Simmons. Tudor Gates, screenwriter.
Mm.
I suppose it's fair to say he's best known, if he's remembered at all, for writing quite a number of those sort of British sex comedies of the 1970s.
Okay.
And if you look at his filmography, his screen credits, The Optimists of Nine Elms is sandwiched, if that's the appropriate phrase.
It's possibly inappropriate. Not inappropriate.
It's sandwiched between The Love Box.
Okay.
And The Sex Thief.
Those are actually quite charmingly modest titles for 1970s sex comedies. Well, they were normally called, like, Keep It Up, Morris, and things like that, weren't they?
Yeah. Why did they never just...
Wiggle It About, Arthur.
You just... Why didn't they ever make a sex comedy for 1974 called...
Except, well, they might as well have done, mightn't they? With three exclamation marks on the end.
Yeah.
Or is that the musical version? Is that the musical sex comedy would be called Four with exclamation marks on the end of it?
It would, like twang.
exactly, yes. Oliver, with an exclamation. You had to have an exclamation mark on the end of a musical. Otherwise, it wasn't a proper musical. So, yeah, there we go.
So, tell me about Anthony Simmons, or Tony Simmons, then.
Didn't Tony Simmons start out as... He was a kind of... He's part of that sort of new wave of British cinema in the early 1960s, wasn't he? He was vaguely sort of kitchen sink affiliated, I think. And certainly part of... Was it called... there's a name for it, isn't there? Was it called Free Cinema?
The Free Cinema movement. Yeah,
that's kind of... We're deliberately making non-commercial films because that's what we do. We're not beholden to the film industry's like money-grabbing auspices.
They made political films, but with a documentary kind of feel.
I got a feeling he was kind of part of that movement, right. But then I know in his later career, he ended up working a lot in TV, and he directed Supergran.
See, my level of research did not extend that far, really.
Absolutely, yes. Along with a lot of other stuff, I think he worked on programs like Cat's Eyes with Leslie Ash and The Professionals. I think he directed quite a bit of The Professionals as well.
Oh.
So it's an eclectic career, isn't it? It's an eclectic career for both of them, really.
Yeah. Well, I think your man Tudor Gates also wrote episodes of The Sweeney.
Oh, did he?
So it's a period of time when you could kind of, if you were in the film industry or the business,
yeah,
as we call it, you know, you could kind of turn your hand to anything. You weren't pigeonholed so much.
I think you can't, and you had to, as a rule, because I remember I've been lucky enough to spend a bit of time over the years with Robin Asquith, who's a charming fella, a wonderful raconteur. And Robin freely admits he made films that weren't the greatest films ever made. In fact, there's one film that he was in is called Queen Kong, and he actively describes it as the worst film ever made. And he says, you know, people say to him, well, why did you do them if you knew they weren't any good? And he basically says, well, that was the British film industry at the time. You know, if you wanted to work as an actor in the 1970s in films, you basically had to be in sex comedies or low-budget horror films, because that was essentially what the British film industry was.
Yeah. Did he ever say what his proudest achievement was? The proudest project he was ever attached to?
I know he was particularly proud of... I mean, Lindsay Anderson.
He was in IF, wasn't he?
He is in IF, and he was handpicked by Lindsay Anderson from... I think he was in a Shakespeare production at school, and Lindsay Anderson was there, kind of obviously looking for young, promising actors, and handpicked him to be in IF. But then he's also... he's quite proud of some of his stage performances as well, because in the early 80s, he was in... He did a bit of Brecht...
Oh,
he
right.
did Arturo Uy. Is it The Irresistible Rise of Arturo Uy? Bertolt Brecht, and he was in that and got really good notices for it.
Okay.
But I'm kind of trying to shake off a little bit, I think, the sort of saucy confession star Robin Asquith image. You know, he will happily make light and make fun of the kind of strange films that he's done over the years, but he's a genuinely great actor, and I have a lot of time for him.
It'd be quite difficult to acclimatise yourself, or you know, if you go to see a Brecht production on stage and you see Robin Asquith, it would take a little bit of time to recalibrate. You expect to see his bare buttocks covered in soap suds or something.
He's in the Canterbury Tales as well, isn't he? The Pasolini's Canterbury Tales.
Oh, really?
He's in that as well. That's one of his early... That might be pre-confessions, just pre-confessions, I think. Yeah, he's absolutely in that. So he's got... I really like Asquith. He's got this bizarre and brilliant career that he'll just talk about until the cows come home.
Yeah.
Not that cows are particularly noted for their insatiable wanderlust that I'm aware of.
You're very strong, aren't you? Very strong. Must be all that hard work you do. What for? People like you bring kids into the world don't know what they're all about. All it can say is, no, no, you can't. No, don't do that. Don't do that. You can't. You can. That's what it's all about, mate. You can. It's not filling their bellies up with bread and butter. What if we had a bit of bread and butter up here? That's where they need it, you know. Put a bit of the old glass ball. Bit of magic. Bit of dream boats going on in here. Tell a person like you that, and may as well tell them to clean their teeth with a whitewash brush. Now, look here. If you interfere with my needs again, I'll give you a swift kick in the gobbles, bring tears to your eyes, twice nightly. Right.
So written by Simmons and also directed by Simmons, very, yes, very ably, I would say.
Yes, absolutely.
Songs and lyrics, original songs and lyrics, I should say, by Lionel Bart.
Yes.
And score by George Martin.
It's not a bad pedigree, is it?
It's not. And starring Peter Sellers as, well, we know him as Sam. He doesn't really have a surname. Although, I want to come to that a little bit later, because I've got a bit of a... I'm a bit confused by something, but we'll talk about that in a bit.
Okay.
We've got... the two children. So it's essentially it's a three-hander, isn't it? It's four if you include Bella the dog.
Yes.
But you've got Sam, who's this a man of indeterminate age, I suppose. But he's an older man, and it's probably, I'm sure he remembers the Titanic going down. Let's put it that
You'd
way.
Think so, wouldn't you? Although it's intriguing, because Sellers was about 47, wasn't he, when he did this? And he looks, by modern standards, if you looked at that character, you'd say, oh, he's about 70.
Yes. Yes.
And I know that Sellers, kind of, you know, he was no stranger to playing older characters. But on this occasion, I don't think he's particularly made up to look old, is he? There's something about his demeanour. That is redolent of an elderly man. It's a brilliant performance.
They've put some grey. They've greyed his hair, or they've put some grey in his hair.
I think in the Roger Lewis book as well, he mentions they gave him false ears.
Yeah, I didn't notice that.
Which I didn't notice that either. There's nothing particularly strange about Sellers' ears in The Optimists of Nine Elms. The teeth I noticed.
The nose though. The nose is the most. You just can't stop looking at the nose.
I looked at it and I thought, is it his actual nose or is it not? I couldn't decide.
No.
It's not. Right, okay.
No, it's like a ski jump, isn't it? It's like the child catcher's nose, almost.
Yeah, I guess so. I think the age is actually in the performance, in the way he holds himself,
yes,
in the way he walks and carries himself, and in the speech as well. Which is, I know that a lot of Sellers' characters are kind of dependent on his vocal mannerisms in order to build the character. But it's such an unusual voice. It's an old Yorkshireman's voice.
Well, it's his dad's voice, he says.
Just about, because I've seen lots of suggestions that Sellers based the character on Dan Leno, who's a music hall star, that he particularly, you know, Sellers was fascinated by him. And at one point seemed to believe that he was actually the reincarnation of Dan Leno. A pinch of salt possibly required with stories like that and Sellers.
Sellers once knocked on Leno's old house,
right?
Disturbing the new occupants, whoever they were.
Yeah.
Basically, just unannounced. He just basically, they opened the door to Peter Sellers. He pushed past them into the hall and shouted, "Dan, it's me, Pete."
Yeah, so it was an interest that went beyond the casual, let's say. So there's suggestions that he based the character of Sam on Dan Leno, but Dan Leno was a Londoner, and Sam is very much not. And I kind of thought, because I knew that Sellers' dad had been a performer, I thought I'll look up and see where his dad was actually from. And it's like, the accounts vary a little bit, but he was a Yorkshireman, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Was it Bingley or Barnsley? I'm not sure.
I've seen Bradford online today, but then I've also seen Nottinghamshire mentioned, which is very certainly not in Yorkshire.
No,
but I think you see, it seems to be a reasonable consensus that he was a kind of West Yorkshireman. I think, yeah.
We must mention, so we've got Sellers as Sam, who we think had been quite a turn as a music hall comedian or entertainer.
Certainly in his head.
In his head, in his heyday, you know, he trod the boards and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
And now as an old man, he's living in a fairly wretched, what is it? Is it a flat?
It's essentially a slum, isn't it? You'd generously describe it as the dock side, the south side of the Thames, but I don't know. But it looks like a derelict old, I don't know, is it an old harbour master's digs or something maybe like that?
Well, apparently
it doesn't look like anybody should be living there, basically.
Apparently it still exists to that today.
It's
still there, but it's been refurbished and renovated or whatever.
I am stunned, because one of the things that I love about The Optimists is the way it did, you know, we see London in 1973 and what an appalling state some of it was in. And I just, I watched it again last night, and I actually made a note, and I never got round to it today. I thought I'm gonna look up and see if I can work out exactly where it was filmed on the south side of the Thames and what's there now, fully expecting to find kind of like billionaires' apartments in the exact same spot. But that building is still there. That has stunned me.
Mm-hmm. Apparently.
Wow.
And yeah, so Sam is now essentially, he's a street entertainer, busker. He's got a little dog called, lovely little dog, again of indeterminate age, but fairly old, called Bella.
Elderly, we think, yeah.
And then we have the two children who both, this was their first and last film, the actors.
Absolutely, which I tend to find a lot with actors of that age, no matter how good they were. And they are both really good in this. They're completely natural, completely convincing. So naturally, I looked them both up today, and absolutely, it's essentially the only thing they ever did, which either goes to show, A, how difficult it was and probably still is for child actors to make the journey into being adult actors and to be taken seriously as adult actors. Although let's be generous, maybe they just didn't want to.
Well, I know the lad, John Chaffee, who played 6-year-old Mark.
Yeah.
He's now a very respected, very renowned osteopath.
Oh, is he? Well, good for him.
He joins that list of famous osteopaths that includes Stephen Ward.
Right.
Donna Mullane played Liz, his older sister. Now, I think she's meant to be, is she, what, 11, 12 maybe, at a push?
Are their ages ever specified?
His is. I think he at one point it's mentioned that he's 6 and she's...
Oh, because, yeah, do you want to see 7?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
And she's she struck me as having a bit of a look of a young Julie Christie about her.
All right, okay, yeah.
Yeah. So she could have got some, she could have got some work playing young Julie Christie in subsequent films, you know, in flashbacks, something like that.
But didn't. No.
So we have these, we've got Liz and Mark, who are the two children, and they're basically, how would you describe them? They're latchkey kids?
Yeah, pretty much, aren't they? They're two kids who, I mean, their parents, I guess very typical 1970s parents, they're just working all the time. And there's not an awful lot of time at home for the kids. So they basically, these two kids just get, that seemed to happen a lot in the 1970s. The kids just got basically shoved outside into the streets. Like, go and entertain yourselves. Get out of our way. Get out of the house. We got stuff to do. Which was a kind of, you know, it was a recurring thing, wasn't it? I wasn't quite as neglected as that in the 1970s, but there was a vague expectation that, you know, I'm perfectly entitled to go and wander the streets or the woods or the parks or whatever for a couple of hours and come back in one piece.
That Saturday began, as most Saturdays did, with them rowing about Dad going off to work and Mum being left on her own with us. But overtime meant more money, and more money meant more chance of that new house they were always talking about.
Liz, your dad's left you some money. It's on the table.
Here, don't forget to clean your teeth.
Yeah.
I think this film takes place across... It spans one weekend to the following weekend, I think.
Right, okay.
I think I'm right in saying that. Yeah, the kids are bored all the time. When they're not at school, they're bored because you've got this horrible... the house that they're living in. It's they're living on top of each other, essentially, aren't they? And they've got...
In, again, essentially a slum.
Yeah. And you've got Ma and Pa arguing, and Liz says that Saturday began as most Saturdays did, with them rowing.
Yeah.
And then you see the two kids out just wandering aimlessly through the mud and the wastage, and it's like a slow meandering day. They've got nothing else to do, and this is how they meet Sam. But I want to mention the parents, because we've got Marjorie Yates, who's one of those actors, you know, I recognized her but I couldn't place her.
Yeah.
As mum. Now I think she's the least sympathetic character in this whole film, because she's the mother, but she doesn't seem to really have any time for the kids at all. Whereas the father, marvellous David Dacre.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a bit of a grumpy old sod, but you can tell that he's got a lot of affection for his kids.
And he kind of sees the error of his ways, doesn't he?
He does.
I don't know what your policy is on this the podcast about spoilers, but...
we will be spoiling, don't worry.
Okay, well, at the end of the film, he kind of sees the error of his ways and the fact that he has been neglecting these kids and wrapped up in his own troubles. I think you've got a little bit of sympathy for him. But it just, I don't know, I guess I write a lot about the 1970s and about Britain of the 1970s. Mm. And I think there's a kind of... There's either a temptation to romanticise the 1970s and say, oh, life was so much simpler and so much happier then. Or there's a sort of temptation to say, well, life wasn't actually that much different in the 1970s. You know, all right, nobody had smartphones. And the telly was better and we all ate Spangles. But apart from that, life wasn't that much different. And I think when I look at the parents in particular in The Optimists of Nine Elms, there's your kind of proof that neither of those were particularly true for huge tracts of the British population, and particularly British working class people in the early 1970s. So basically both of Liz and Mark's parents are kind of struggling to survive it's almost like a post-war Britain still. We haven't quite moved into modern Britain. There are hints of it, you know, and in particular, you know, as we'll maybe move on to later, the kind of suggestion that the family is going to move to this swanky new council flat. So there are hints of modernity in there. But we find them in this horrible, sort of squalid slum where, like you say, they're just living on top of each other. You suspect they don't have any central heating. You know, that how damp and horrible does that flat look?
Yep.
You suspect, are they on the phone? I'm not entirely sure they are. Lots of
Probably
people
not.
That I knew in the 1970s weren't on the phone. I mean, there were still kind of stragglers in the 1970s that didn't have electricity in their houses. So and it's a kind of part of the 1970s that we don't really talk about that much. But the fact that, you know, life was just horrible for a lot of people. And these poor sods, this poor couple with two kids, are just working they're working back-breaking jobs, both in what appear to be full-time factory jobs. But, you know, maybe they did love it, but I'm going to suggest there wasn't an awful lot of job satisfaction going on there.
No.
And they're just permanently grumpy at their kids.
Mum, the mother did have one perk of her job, working in the laundry. She could, along with the other ladies, they could all ogle a young Keith Chegwin.
Cheggers! I know! An uncredited Keith Chegwin without a single line as well. All he has to do is kind of look a bit to look a bit scared of these older women.
Yeah,
and I don't blame him.
They call him Passion and Pants.
Is it Keith Chegwin's first film appearance? It can't be far off.
Can't be far off.
No, no. Absolutely. yeah, that was... I'd totally forgotten that he was in it, so I laughed out loud. Because you hear them talking about him first, don't you? Yeah. They're kind of talking about this Lothario, this workplace Lothario that they're all lusting after.
And you think, oh, it's going to be some young actor that, like, who went on to great things like Lewis Collins.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's Cheggers. It's Cheggers Place Pop. Or Cheggers Drinks Pop, as it probably was at that point. A bottle of Vimto in his hand.
And David Dacre, all, you know, my notes here.
Yeah.
So I'm calling her mum, but I'm not calling him dad in my notes. I'm just calling him David Dacre.
He's David Dacre. Brilliant actor, David Dacre.
Yeah, because he is now. Does he work? Is it a gasworks or a foundry that he's working in? I can't work it out.
I can't either. It's heavy industry, isn't it? Let's go that far.
Yeah. So, but David Dacre, can we just pause for a moment, because I was talking to mates about him. He cornered the market in playing feckless fathers, really, didn't he? Because he was in Time Bandits as well as the.
Of course he is. Yes.
As the father who doesn't really bother with his young son.
Yeah.
And of course he was second banana in Boone.
Or second he was indeed, yes.
But I remember him mainly because I grew up watching Coronation Street with my mum.
Ah, okay.
And I remember him in the late 70s, early 80s, recurring character that would come and go called Gordon Lewis, who was...
Did he?
When Mrs. Walker was away, he'd come and manage the Rovers, much to the chagrin of Bette and Betty.
Right, okay.
And Hilda.
Supply. Was he the supply landlord?
That supply kind of landlord. Thing. That'll do. Yeah.
Ah, Bet. Welcome aboard, just as we're about to sail. Should you make a few pork sandwiches before the rush starts?
Food's Betty's job.
It's all hands to the pump, Bet, on a day like this. Anyway, it's experience, isn't it?
Experience for what? I'm not thinking of opening a transport cafe.
I know. A mate in the general office tells me that you've applied for the job of manager here. Is that right?
That's right. I have.
Well, if you can tell him what a good pork sandwich you make, it might do you a bit of good. You never know.
And of course, he was a member of the Lindsay Anderson company, really, wasn't he? Because he was an O'Lucky Man, and I think he was in...
Of course. In
Britannia Hospital he was in as well.
Oh, with Robin Asquith. Oh,
there you go.
You see, I measure out my entire life as a TV viewer by Doctor Who, because I'm a huge Doctor Who fan. So David Dacre was obviously, he was in the 1979 Doctor Who story, The Nightmare of Eden, playing the captain of a hyperspace liner.
Okay. He's all gruff, rugged,
yes,
slightly on the make. Type characters.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've no firm evidence to back this up, but I'm going to boldly suggest he will have played a villain in The Sweeney, in The Professionals, in Minder, in virtually every TV program of the 70s or 80s that required somebody a bit rough and ready of a certain age. Will have been David Dacre.
If Michael Alphick's not available, get Dacre on the phone.
Absolutely, yes. And if you've got a budget, get them both. as indeed they did on Boone.
Yes. So we've got Sam, who is this entertainer, street entertainer, who's got his little dog, and he's got he pushes an old, like a Victorian pram full of his entertainer tackle.
Yeah. That's what you want to call it.
And Bella, and typically he will play his ukulele, he will sing songs, yes, he will dance, and Bella the dog, she will beg with an enamel mug in her mouth. And he's clearly very attached to Bella, and she's all he's got, really.
There's a lovely scene, isn't there, where Sam essentially describes basically how everybody he's ever loved has deserted him.
Yeah.
I think he says His wife took the baby and left him standing on the platform at Crewe Station, I think is the actual line.
Yeah.
So his wife has gone. I think there are suggestions that he has quite a few other kids as well, and they've all gone. He has no contact with any of those. So dogs, he absolutely espouses dogs as the only reliable company you can find. He's had such an appalling history with human beings that dogs are the only sentient creatures that he will trust. And even you can see it in, you know, in the early stages of the film. He doesn't trust the kids either. He doesn't want the kids follow him around. And basically because they're taking the mickey out of him to begin with, you know, basically trailing after him down the street, shouting, "Sam, Sam, dirty old man." Because like you say, they're bored and they've been turfed out of the house. And Sam doesn't want them anywhere near him. He, you know, very, very reluctant to forge any kind of friendship with them. And it's only in, you know, as the film reaches its halfway mark, he starts to thaw, doesn't he, at that point. But he's very, you know, dogs are where he's at, basically.
Well, I think I was getting the impression, probably wrongly, that, yeah, the first day that he meets the kids when they're, like you say, they're taking the mick, they're calling him names and they're antagonizing him, I suppose. Yeah, I he's genuinely annoyed. But I think the next day he's waiting. I think he's waiting for them to turn up.
He does ultimately,
and he'd be disappointed if they didn't, although he pretends that he's
indifferent
to them being there. I think that feeling.
I think he's just, the great thing about Sam is that although he's living in such reduced circumstances, he is in this awful squalid, you know, whatever it is, it's hard to make out where he's living, or, you know, who is he paying rent to for that? God, is he paying rent to anybody, or is he basically just squatting there? It's difficult to tell. But despite the fact that he's living in that way, and Sellers kind of plays it, it's never explicitly stated apart from the end, but I think Sellers plays him slightly drunk all the way through. So he kind of stumbles over his words and he slurs and he's incoherent at times. We see him properly drunk at the end of the film, but I think all the way through there's a suggestion that Sam is a kind of like a functioning alcoholic.
Yeah.
So despite all of this, he has the most extraordinary pride and dignity, which borders on delusions of grandeur. So, you know, when he takes the kids past the Dorchester Hotel, he sort of sniffily says, "Oh, the chef there makes a very good Grand Marnier souffle." Like the suggestion being that he's lived that life at some point, or that he is still in his head living that life. And I think part of that dignity is the fact that he's very, very private, and that's kind of all he's got. All he's got to hold on to is his privacy and this squalid flat or whatever it is that he lives in. So the kids for a long time feel like an intrusion into that, I think.
When you say you mentioned they pass the Dorchester Hotel.
Yeah.
And Sellers obviously glances across at it. And of course, it was there that he was to have his final heart attack 7.5 years later.
Oh gosh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, that blimey. He wasn't having the Grand Marnier souffle at the time, was he? That's a terrible thought. I don't know, I'd never made that connection. That's poignant.
It's quite interesting that sequence. Okay, we're gonna go back and forth with this discussing this film. But,
sorry,
but that's fine.
You off the beaten track here.
That's fine, but it's interesting because they pass the Dorchester, which obviously would be where Sellers would ultimately spend his last days. And then they're walking through London, and you see them pass the Windmill Cinema.
Yeah,
which was obviously the Windmill Theatre, which is where Sellers began his career.
Right, yeah.
Like so many others. Little nod there, I think. I'm going to say this now. I think this film would have been a perfect send-off for Sellers because, you know, his last film, you know what his last film was.
Yeah.
The Fu Manchu film.
Yeah.
But if this film had been his last film, I think it would have been quite fitting because it's quite nostalgic. It's looking back and you've got him walking past things, places like the Windmill where he started out. He's channeling his dad and Dan Leno, who was his spirit guide, I suppose. I don't know. And it would be a natural follow-on from being there because it's very similar in tone in some ways. And it's not a knockabout farce. It's a love letter to London. So much of his life and career was spent in London. And it's heartening back to a different era of entertainment, which Sellers as a child would have absorbed because he was touring with his folks all over.
It feels to me like the most, as much as you can ever tell with Sellers, because he was such a closed book in so many ways, it feels like the most personal
of
his performances, because and when he is performing the songs and the, you know, because Sam just, particularly in the first half of the film, Sam just slips into, you know, about half of his speech is basically made up of his old music hall routines, and he's constantly dropping, you know, ridiculous puns and rhymes and things into his speech, almost involuntarily. And you can't, I mean, I haven't read the novella, and I haven't, you know, I've never seen the script to this film. I wonder how much of that came from Sellers himself, from his background as a, you know, not as a music hall performer himself, obviously, but, you know, as somebody who had that lineage, you know, his father was, and his heroes were music hall performers. Because I thought it was really interesting that he performs I Haven't Told Her, She Hasn't Told Me in this film, which kind of, like, if you Googled that song now, all you will get is references to Peter Sellers. You'd be forgiven for thinking almost that Peter Sellers had written it himself. It became his party piece, didn't it? He would, you know, he had to be forcibly restrained when he went on the chat show from bringing out the ukulele and singing I Haven't Told Her, She Hasn't Told Me.
It's on the famous Parkinson interviews.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
We always end up talking about Parkinson, don't we?
God rest his soul.
Absolutely, yes. But yeah, so he would do that. So the fact that that's included in this film makes me... I mean, surely Sellers brought that to the party himself. It seems to have been a song that meant so much to him.
What you playing?
It's private. Jim and oh golly gosh oh gee, I've fallen in love and so is she. I haven't told her, hasn't told me, but we know it just the same. Saturday night on her settee, oh what a time there's going to be. I haven't told her, hasn't told me, but we know it just the same. She still calls me mister, but she won't, no she won't, after I've kissed her. I've got an idea, soon she'll be cooking my breakfast, wait and see. I haven't told her, hasn't told me, but
I had a look, because in my head I thought, oh, it's a George Formby song, purely because it's on the ukulele, but it's not at all. Formby might have done it at some point, but the original, as far as I could tell, was a B-side by Art Fowler from 1927. It was the B-side to a song called No Wonder She's a Blushing Bride.
Right.
So, you know, you assume Sellers... I'd heard that or that. When was he born? 1925?
Yeah.
So that would have, you know, that songs like that would have been around during his very early childhood. He must have brought that to the party.
Well, I think
himself.
I'm sure he said on Sellers, I'm sure he said that his dad had performed that as part of his act. And of course, something I picked up on, I'm sure there's probably no connection, it's just coincidental, but the lyrics of I Haven't Told Her, She Hasn't Told Me, that... At one point, one of the lyrics is, she still calls me mister, but she won't. I know she won't after I've kissed her. But what do the kids call him all the way through the film?
Tom, mister, see you tomorrow.
Mister, they do.
They never call him Sam. They call him Sam right at the beginning when
they
call him.
They do at the start when they're
dirty
when
old man
the mickey
Sam
out of
or whatever.
Him. Yeah.
But for the rest of the film, they just call him mister.
Sorry, mister.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a bit of that around, isn't there? I'd never made that connection. So do you think he's singing it to them?
I don't know.
I think that's a coincidence.
Yeah.
But it is a lovely old song. I say that I cannot believe that Sellers didn't bring that to the film himself.
He probably did.
Cuz there's stuff he says catchphrases that were like old musical catchphrases that weren't... I mean, some of this stuff was created for the film by Tony Simmons, I think, because there's a line, there's a rhyme that he does, isn't there, about the Sugar Mouse came back in... I wrote it down somewhere. I'm going to find this.
Okay.
I bet I can't find it now. Oh.
While you're looking, though, he's got all these little quips, like he says... maybe means perhaps, and perhaps means if, and if means maybe.
That's right. Yes. And yeah, there's a line that he does. It's a rhyme where he says, "I can't go home," the old man said, "there's a rat inside me house." The little girl laughed and said, "Don't be daft, it's only a pink sugar mouse." Which you thought, well, that must be an old routine, and it's not. That was written by Tony Simmons, apparently.
Right.
But then he also, one of Sam's other lines, he says, I don't wish to know that. Kindly leave the stage."
Yes.
Which is Murray and Mooney, who were of music hall turn, and I think made the jump to radio very briefly as well. But Murray and Mooney were the duo that coined the phrase "I say, I say, I say" before you tell a joke. They were the first ones to do that. "I say, I say, I say." I think it was Mooney would do a terrible joke, to which Murray would respond, "I don't wish to know that. Kindly leave the stage."
Well, they used to use that line a lot in The Goons.
Of course, yes. So
Sellers
there you go.
Sellers and Milligan, yeah. Would, as you know, when they were performing tired, old, washed up comedian roles.
So they ignore it. It's Murray and Mooney.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. I also picked up on, I don't know if you did as well, because Mark, little Mark, you know, because he's a child, he's the innocence of youth.
Hmm.
You know, he's smitten by Bala, isn't he? He's very taken by Bala.
Totally.
The dog.
Yeah.
And he asks about what happens when she dies quite early on.
Hmm.
Or he asks about, will she have a funeral? And that pretty much is where we have the setup for which sort of sustains us for the rest of the movie, in a way. He's talking about what will happen when Bala dies, and will he have a funeral? And he keeps saying, you know, will he have a wonderful funeral, Mister? Will it be bigger than Queen Victoria's, Mister?
Mm.
Which, for a 6-year-old in 1973 to know about Queen Victoria's funeral,
true, yes.
But interesting. Because it's quite funny, he says that. He says, "Will it be bigger than Queen Victoria's?" And then Sam says,
"Oh, I'm she's lopsided."
Oh, I didn't pick up on that. What is that, a reference to something?
Well, yeah. Well, okay. So Sellers' first proper film.
Yeah.
The Lady Killers, 1955.
Yeah.
We covered it a couple of weeks ago. Okay. The nickname for the lady in the film, elderly lady, is Mrs. Lopsided.
Okay. Right, of course.
And there's a key scene in the movie where she talks about Queen Victoria's funeral. She says it was her 21st birthday when Queen Victoria passed away.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm just wondering, again, this may be me overthinking it, when little Mark mentions Queen Victoria's funeral, did that spark off in Sellers' head, oh, the Lady Killers line? And that's why he called him Mrs. Lopsided.
Is this Sellers getting a bit meta here?
Yeah, I just wondered.
Oh, it's like the Marvel Expanded Universe, isn't it? It's the Sellers Expanded Universe.
Yeah. They're talking about this dog cemetery, or Sam's talking about this dog cemetery, and Liz is sceptical that it exists.
Yeah.
And for a while, you do think that he's just made up this whole notion that there isn't a dog cemetery. Or a pet cemetery. Yeah. I think I've got this right.
Yeah.
And the kids try and get him to promise to take them to take them to it.
Yeah.
And eventually he does. Now, this was a fascinating bit of the film, this Hyde Park pet cemetery. Had you heard about this before?
I had not until I saw The Optimists a few years ago, and I remember looking it up then. And being quite astounded. So this is a genuine pet cemetery, which is still there. It's not open to the public anymore, is it? It's kind of cordoned off and a bit overgrown, from what I can tell. But it was a popular pet cemetery, sort of late 19th century, early 20th century. And it's got vague connections to royalty, hasn't it? There are some royal pets that were buried in the Hyde Park Pet Cemetery.
Of course. Of course there are. Yeah. I mean,
I think it was, like, again, possibly part of Sam's delusions of grandeur. Of course he thinks his dog is going to be buried in the royal the royal dog's graveyard. Of course he does. In his head, he dines at the Dorchester.
Well, he says later in the film when Bella's died. Sorry, folks, spoilers. But he says at the end, the cemetery's been, he says something like, the cemetery's been closed 100 years, but they'll open it up for us, won't they?
Exactly, yes. So all he's got to cling on to is this dream that even though he's in reduced circumstances, his reputation is such that it, you know, there will be this extraordinary outbreak of public mourning when him and indeed his dog have gone.
Yeah, and so the actual pet cemetery was established around 1881 in the garden of Victoria Lodge in Hyde Park.
Hmm.
And yeah, it became popular because they buried a dog belonging to Sarah Fairbrother, who was the wife of the Duke of Cambridge.
That'll be it. That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, and over apparently 1,000 burials were carried out before the cemetery was more or less closed in 1903. But there were there was very sporadic burials right up until 1976. And it's mostly dogs, but there's a few cats, monkeys, and some birds. And apparently George Orwell visited the cemetery, right, which he described as perhaps the most horrible spectacle in Britain.
All right, okay. Oh, I hesitate to suggest that Orwell had led a sheltered life.
Yeah.
It's hard not to resist the temptation to say so.
Yeah, but trust George to put a downer on everything. Put a downer on a cemetery. I was looking at some photos of some of the headstones, because they've all got little headstones. And there's one dog called Scum.
Oh, bless.
Do you think he was loyal?
Poor little thing. We have a working class dog in the household. What shall we call him? Scum, dear.
Scum. He drops his H's.
Poor thing.
But yes, I love that whole sequence. So they get a bus to Hyde Park. Mm. Mark runs to the gents' public toilets because his boots are too tight.
That's right.
Sam says. Yeah, everything Sam says is like musical patter, isn't it?
It's a joke. Virtually everything he says is a joke, certainly in the early stages of the film. My friend Mike Scott, who we chat a lot with on Twitter, he has a thing. I always seem to cite Mike Scott's theories about comedy when I do podcasts.
Yeah.
Just because he's good. I think his theory is that sitcoms and comedy films are basically like opera. So although the characters are having normal conversations, we don't hear them as normal conversations. We, you know, in opera, you hear them as songs.
Yep.
And so Mike thinks in sitcoms, like in their heads, the characters are having just real conversations, but we hear them as jokes. They can't stop doing jokes. Mm. That's just the format. They're not necessarily literally saying jokes in the real world of that sitcom, but that's how we hear it. I genuinely thought of that theory when I watched The Optimists of Nine Elms, because Sam cannot stop doing that. Basically, everything he says, certainly in the first hour or so of the film, his entire conversation almost is conducted in like you say, patter, in fragments and snippets of old music hall routines. And you just think, well, God, the poor sod has been, you know, when do you think the last time, you know, when was the last time that Sam actually performed on a stage? You know, you've got to speculate. It's kind of been 40 years since he last appeared on a stage.
Pre-war.
Yeah, certainly, but all of his old routines are still rattling around in his head, and you have to say when Sam stroke Sellers, and I suspect on these occasions there is a great deal of crossover between the two, when Sam stroke Sellers are actually required to perform, he's genuinely brilliant. He's not, you know, he's not deluded at all. He's not a kind of washed up performer that is now a sad shadow of whatever glory. I mean, you know, in terms of his real life, he is. But as a performer, he's not at all. He's actually pretty damn good. There's that amazing scene where, and I, you know, being a football fan, my immediate thought obviously was, oh, I wonder which match that is. Because it's quite obviously a real match with real fans going to a football game. And I've not been able to pin down the actual match itself, but it's Fulham, I think, isn't it? It's Craven Cottage.
That's right, yep. Yeah. I like the way, because there's a fight that breaks out and you get a brief bit of handheld camera.
There's a bit of chew, isn't there?
Well, yeah,
a bit of genuine argy-bargy.
It's filmed in a very naturalistic style with handheld camera.
And
so Sam begins busking and his heart's not really in it at first because there's a lot of, like, argy-bargy going on around him.
Yeah.
And then Mark leads Bella to the queue
Absolutely.
With the mug, and everyone starts putting money in. And yeah. Sam kind of rallies, if you know what I mean, and puts on a really good performance.
Oh, they used to call her Mary, and then they took the R away. Oh, she wanted to be a flapper, you see, with a cute little name like May. And then a yokeman came romancing, and in a year they called him Pa. So they took the Y away from me, and now they call her, what do they call her? Yes, they all call her Ma.
And at that point, he's brilliant.
Yeah.
And again, in Roger Lewis's book, you know, there was no other way of doing it. They genuinely took Sellers down to a Fulham match and got him to perform outside. Not a single person recognised him.
Yeah.
Despite the fact, I assume, you know, there's bloody big film cameras everywhere, not a single person stopped. Because they took binders with him as well, didn't they? Right, probably David Dacre.
Yes.
But they took a couple of heavies down just in case any football fans did think, oh, it's Peter Sellers, let's plant one on him. But nobody recognised him at all. They seemed to genuinely think it was just an old busker in the street.
Yeah. Well, I suppose. Because here's the thing, and I'm ashamed to admit it, but you know when you walk past somebody busking or even somebody selling the big issue or whatever, sometimes it's very easy not to even look at them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Especially in this day and age when nobody carries cash anymore, I always feel absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
I think, you know, because at a point in my life, I would until quite recently, I would happily have delved into my pocket and you know, chucked a few pennies, a few coins in the direction of anyone like that. But I don't carry cash anymore, not through any deliberate decision. That's just the way life has gone, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you look down the street, you can kind of see, you can see people very casually, like walking in a semicircle.
Yes.
to avoid eye contact. Yes. Basically, it's very sad.
Yeah.
But I suspect most of us are guilty of it from time to time.
Yeah.
So people are doing that to Sellers. But it's interesting because seeing Sellers performing in the street like that did kind of take me back to my childhood being in town centres. And I know that obviously you do still get buskers now, and you do get, you know, I was in Middlesbrough town centre last week, and there were two women, you know, singing beautifully and brilliantly to a backing tape, so that still happens. But I'd totally forgotten the phenomenon of, like, it wasn't just singers that you got in the street, and Sellers isn't just a singer, he's an entertainer in the street. And there's that, you know, in The Optimists of Nine Elms, there's that footage as well of the guy with the birds. He's got like budgies on a stick that he's singing to, and they're performing along to his song.
Yeah.
And you would get people like that. And I guess it was an age where, you know, performers that had made their name in variety and had been on the stage, once that particular outlet was gone for them, a lot of them would have ended up busking on the street and not necessarily singing traditional songs, but doing their variety turn, their comedy, their patter, their magic tricks in the street. And I remember stuff like that happening when I was a kid in the 70s. I think so much of the melancholy of The Optimists of Nine Elms, it's not, we're building it to be this incredibly depressing film, and ultimately it's not particularly, you know, it's called The Optimists with some justification, but so much of the melancholy of the film is so tied in with the passing of that tradition of variety for me. It's
yes.
absolutely the fag end of it.
Yep.
And these performers who are now, you know, it's never specified how old Sam himself is. You guess he's probably meant to be about 70, even though Sellers himself was nowhere near. It's absolutely the last of that generation of music hall performers trying to eke out a living. It's so sad, but beautifully done.
And it's also, it's hopefully the last generation of people having to live in those slums. They're all wanting to move into nice new flats.
Yeah. Well, that's again, an interesting subplot of the film for me. So we talked about the, you know, the way it depicts that that ultra grim version of 1970s British life. But it's also on the cusp of the new era. So, you know, the kids, I mean, it's almost like a promised land, isn't it, for the kids? They keep looking across the Thames to these wonderful, probably all rack concrete. Probably being demolished as we speak. But they keep looking over the Thames to this promised land of what are then absolutely spanking new. But you know, they're flats. They're council. I think it's stated, isn't it? They're council flats.
They are, yeah.
But for them, it's, you know, this is the new life. They're gonna have an inside toilet for the first time in their life. I think there's a scene, isn't there, where you say you'll have to get used to doing that indoors or something. I think David Baker says that to the kids.
Yeah.
So it's just on the cusp of Britain really trying to put that wartime or post-war austerity bleakness behind itself.
Yes.
And move forward into the modern world. I honestly think it's a really fascinating period of British history for exactly that reason. It's absolutely the fag end. It's the last bit, really, of old kind of pre-war, pre-technology Britain.
Yeah.
But people are still not quite able to make the jump, or some people are not quite able to make the jump.
Well, Liz is very aspirational for a 11, 12 year old.
Yeah.
She keeps looking yearningly across the water at these flats.
Yeah.
And they look, you look at them now, they look grim to modern eyes, but they must have seemed the epitome of class back then.
Totally. Have you seen the Likely Lads movie?
Yes. Yes,
I love the scene in that where Bob and Terry are, they're in the rubble of their old pub because the streets are being demolished, and they've had a couple of drinks.
Are they wearing something? Are they sitting in something from the pub that they've salvaged?
They've got their pints in their hands and they're on the. Has Bob got a workman's helmet on?
They've got definitely a feeling had a few drinks, they're wearing something. Yeah,
is there? But they're kind of. Right, Bob is getting poetic about the old slums that have been pulled down. These streets had poetry, and Terry, who, you know, Bob's got out. Bob doesn't have to live there anymore. He's on the Elm Lodge housing estate, his beautiful middle class estate with his new wife. And Terry is the one who's actually been moved. You know, he's being moved to the new high-rise apartment blocks, and he's not remotely sentimental about the poetry of the old slums. He's like, you must be joking. New flats? Absolutely wonderful. I've got an inside bog. I've got, you know, central heating and hot running water. You must be joking. So there's that. The people that got out are very quick to romanticise.
Yes.
These places, but those that didn't, those that are still waiting to move out, as I think Terry says, there's not much poetry about padding out in the freezing cold to an outside bog.
the sequence when they go to the pet cemetery and then they go, and Sam does his dancing and conjuring tricks with the kids in the in central London.
Yeah.
They then go to this kind of Greasy Spoon calf.
Oh.
And Liz says they have to go, and it's quite interesting how Liz says they have to go home, and Sam, you can tell Sam's formed such an attachment to the kids that he says, well, I thought we were going to see the flats.
Yeah,
you know,
that calf is filthy as well,
isn't it?
You notice the state of the floor. He puts a saucer of tea down for Bella the dog, and the floor is absolutely rancid. There is half an inch of filth on the floor of that cafe.
What, suck your shoes off?
What on Teesside would be called a claggy mat. It sticks to your shoes as you walk around. Yeah, no, particularly nasty.
Yeah.
And the irony, isn't it, is that the kids think they're being moved across the river. this absolute pipe dream of living on the other side of the river. We're gonna live north of the river in this beautiful kind of brutalist concrete clean modernity. Well, in actual, ultimately, where they can have a dog, where they're allowed to have a dog, because they've seen people there with dogs. And they've got it completely wrong, haven't they? They're not actually moving across the river at all. They're staying. They're moving to a new flat, but it's in Nine Elms.
It's in Nine
and
Elms.
They're not allowed to have dogs.
Here, get your chops round that, love. What's up? Have you lost something?
We have to go. Oh.
You see, I thought that you said that you were going to take me to see the flats. That's what I thought, anyway. Still, don't matter. I've got an idea. Why don't we all go and see the flats? And we can see the flats at the same time.
I tell you what genuinely surprised me, because I looked up some of the critical reaction to it from the time, and it's really interesting, and for me it completely misunderstands the film. So Variety described The Optimists of Nine Elms as acceptable family fare. And for much of its first 80 minutes, it engagingly achieves a sense of fantasy. It's like, God, really? What kind of fantasy are you thinking of here? Because I think it's grim as hell for the first 80 minutes. And the New York Times, who, possibly not the best arbiters of kind of grimy British 1970s life. But they described it as the sort of old-fashioned excursion into sentiment that ought to warm the hearts of parents in search of that elusive piece of merchandise that goes under the name of good family entertainment. I'm not sure. I mean, I know that, but, you know, the filter was off slightly in the 1970s as to what was considered suitable entertainment for children. I don't think putting kids into a film necessarily makes it a children's film. If I'd have seen The Optimists of Nine Elms at the age of 6 or 7, I think I would have been pretty, I think, depressed and baffled by it.
Well, I just
God, I was fairly depressed and baffled by it when I watched it 10 years ago for the first time. It's only now that I'm 50 that I start to think, oh, yeah.
Well, I was just thinking as well then. Can you think of anything less glamorous and sexy than a very short scene where David Dacre is in bed and he's getting amorous with
what's the line?
He says it'll only take 5 minutes, and she just mutters, "I better lock the door then."
Oh God! Yes, I'd forgotten about that. It'll only take 5 minutes. Oh, brilliant. And they say romance is dead.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't have got that in a children's film, Foundation film,
no.
Would you? But it's interesting. I guess the one thing it does have in common, a lot of children's film Foundation films are kind of, and I think a lot of children's cinema of that era has a... like an undercurrent of not only are the kids right, but kind of authority, you know, authority figures, parents, teachers, even policemen sometimes, are all wrong. They're basically in the wrong.
Yeah, and
the kids are the ones we should take our moral compass from in these films, you know, in a lot of children's film foundation films. Because they're imaginative and they're kind of generally on the side of righteousness.
Yeah.
And there's often, in those films, there's often a character who doesn't, you know, who isn't an authority figure. It's somebody who's not a child, who's a grown-up, but they're kind of living outside of normal grown-up society. You know, there will be, it will be an old guy in a shed, or, you know, the local eccentric who believes in aliens or monsters or whatever, and the kids will befriend him, and they will all transpire to be right. And
yes.
Sam kind of fulfills that figure in this film. And it's, I mean, I dare say, you know, if you wanted to make a film now about basically a, you know, an elderly down and out who befriends two very young children and spends all day with them, unknown to their parents, I think it would quite, you know, eyebrows would rightly be raised in 2023. So, well, what actually is the relationship here?
Yeah.
But in 1973, you know, for whatever reasons, that doesn't seem to have occurred to anybody. It was an era when kind of people were, or it was seen as kind of acceptable for children to make friends with adults and for people just to trust the adults. And as we've discovered in, you know, in recent decades, that trust was often completely misguided and misplaced.
Indeed.
But I don't think, you know, there's no hint of that in The Optimists of Nine Elms. I think there's, you know, Sam is genuinely just a lonely man who wants to. Well, I think he sees a bit of his younger self in them, doesn't he? They've still got the idealism, and because that, you know, that scene at the end when Sam talks to David Dacre, the dad character. And says, you just say no to them all the time. Why you say no to them all the time? Say yes to them. Mm-hmm. Let them have a let them be happy. Use your imagination. Let them find magic in the world.
Yeah. Whereas Sellers in real life would not have taken that advice on board.
That's the ironic thing, isn't it? I find it so hard to reconcile Sam with what we think we know of Sellers, you know, particularly during that period. I think Sam is genuinely, he might be the most likable character Sellers ever played. He's genuinely lovely. There's no malice in him at all. He's a little bit tetchy with the kids in the first part of the film, but I think that's just because he's
probably
generally been suspicious about people, full stop.
Well, he's probably been heckled by kids all, you know, for the last 20 years.
Yes, it's what they do. That's what these kids do to him as well. I think Sam as a character, he's kind of adorable.
Yeah.
I'd want to spend time with him. I'd go and listen to his stories all day.
Sam's a fully rounded character. He's not a caricature. He's a fully rounded.
He could have been.
Easily. And he doesn't dial up the drunkenness as well when he's playing drunk. He doesn't.
No, I think, because they say through most of the film, I wasn't sure whether Sam was meant to be drunk or not. And I think it's only at the final scene when Bella, the dog, dies and you know, Sam is very definitely drunk. He's surrounded by empty bottles and he's falling over and slurring and he's angry. I think before that, Sam is always drunk, but it's not made. No deal is made of it.
No. Now you know, people like watching old films and identifying locations. Where was that filmed? And you know, and I do that myself. But I'm always one. I love watching films and trying to work out when it was filmed, because sometimes you'll see in a film, like in the film Villain, for example, you see a very clear front page of a newspaper.
Oh, yes.
And
what is there here?
And Frenzy, there's a, I think it's outside Paddington Station or one of the train stations, there's like a magazine rack in the film Frenzy, and there's lots of magazine covers that you can very clearly see. And I spent, you know, I spent hours sort of like looking at screenshots trying to identify what's on the covers, you know, because I'm sad like that. Now,
you say sad. That sounds like an entirely laudable pastime to me.
I'd already worked out that this film would have been filmed in the winter of 72 into 73.
Okay.
You can tell by the trees. Okay.
But
if you, I don't know if you noticed this, when they were, so they passed the Windmill Cinema in London, and there's at one point when they stop outside a theatre.
Are you going to mention Julia Foster here?
No.
I thought I saw Julia Foster's name.
Oh, well, you may well have done. What caught my eye? You see Sam standing in front of a theatre.
Yeah.
We don't know which theatre.
Yeah.
We do now, because I did a bit of detective work. He's standing behind him very... You can just about make out Peter Cook and Dudley Moore on a poster.
Oh, really?
And it's the poster of, promoting Behind the Fridge.
Behind the Fridge, yeah.
Because it's, I think it's Cook without his trousers on and Moore without a top on.
I didn't spot that. Right. Brilliant. So when was that?
So that was performed at the Cambridge Theatre.
Yeah.
From 21st of November, 72.
Yeah.
To August, 73.
Wow. I mean, it's a bit of a window, isn't it?
True, but... Well,
we need to find the match. If we can find the football match,
but no,
that's
but,
it, nailed.
But on the 20th of February 1973, there was a Tuesday documentary on screened on BBC Two.
Okay.
Called The Big Screen.
Yeah.
And it's John Schlesinger and Gerald Thomas.
Right.
Talking about the British film industry, basically. And it showed the filming of four British films in production at around that time. So obviously it was screened in February 73.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to think about the turnaround. but we saw Live and Let Die being filmed.
Right.
We saw the film The Final Programme, which...
Oh, blimey, which that's I've a very seen. Strange film, yes.
Yeah, John Finch is in that, yeah. I think.
That's a very curious British sci-fi film, isn't it? Dystopian.
It is.
Is that the
one?
Yeah.
And it's got people like Ronald Lacey and people like that.
Yeah.
And a film called The 14, which I've never heard of, right? But also, what do you think I'm going to say? The Optimists of Nine Elms.
Right.
And you see, it sort of bookends the documentary. You see right at the beginning, Sellers as Sam. And then right at the end, a small sequence of where the, you know, you can see the crew, you can see the cameras and everything they're filming. The bit where they're having the impromptu picnic. So to me, I reckon that this film was probably filmed around about November, December into January, something like that, 72, 73.
Amazing.
Their end of
well, there
the...
you go. So I was born on the 15th of November 1972. So I wonder if they were filming a scene that very day.
Ah, there you go.
That's nice to think.
Yes.
Oh, if we could please somebody get in touch and find the football match for us. That is quite clearly a genuine Fulham match. Fulham are at home. It's going to be a Saturday because, you know, back in those halcyon days, football matches actually took place at 3 p.m. on a Saturday. So if we can find that, we've nailed it.
Yeah.
But do you know what I love? Because last time we did this and we talked about the blockhouse, didn't we pinpoint the dates of Peter Sellers' beard growth?
We did, yes.
Via his appearances on chat shows, particularly Parkinson.
And we know that he didn't have a beard in the last day of April, 72, because the last Goon Show of All
that's right,
was filmed.
Yes. But then he appeared on Parkinson when?
In October 72.
And he had a full bushy beard at that point.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's the same beard that he's got in the blockhouse. Brilliant.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, blimey. Well, can I tell you my little, that there's I think we both like kind of placing actors from these films into other things.
Yep.
The little bit that made me genuinely, and what a sad reflection of my life this is, but I genuinely punched the air when I saw her, and I recognised her straight away. there's a tiny scene where the kids are at school. And there's a teacher at the blackboard, and the teacher is played by Hilary Crane, who only a few years later turned up playing Tucker Jenkins' mum in early series of Grange Hill, which I've been watching recently. So hey, there's Tucker's mum. And she played, I say early series, she started off, I think she's in the very first episode of Grange Hill. In fact, I know for certain that she is.
Was she in Tucker's Luck?
Yeah.
Well?
Yeah. She's in the very first episode of Grange Hill, seeing Tucker off at the door when Alan comes to call for him. I think it's Benny. I think it's Alan and Benny that come calling for him. And then... she played Tucker's mum all the way through Grange Hill, and she is Tucker's mum in Tucker's Luck as well. Hilary, the brilliant Hilary Crane. So there you go.
I noticed the actor playing the policeman was an actor I've never heard of, but with a very Toast of London name, Bruce Purchase?
Bruce Purchase is another Doctor Who actor. There you go. I can chuck that in. He plays the pirate captain in the Douglas Adams scripted story, The Pirate Planet, from 1978. What a life I've lived, eh?
It's like talking to Toby Haydock.
Oh, I'm nowhere near on Haydock level. I can only aspire to be the walking IMDb that Toby Haydock is. He's extraordinary.
And of course, in this film,
yes,
one familiar face in this film briefly.
Yes,
Patricia Brake.
Patricia Brake, Porridge, Fletcher's daughter, our Ingrid.
Yes,
Porridge and Going Straight.
Yeah,
yeah. In charge of admin at Battersea Dogs Home. Those are interesting scenes, aren't they?
That dog's home is so, I mean, I
don't want to disparage the great work that Battersea Dogs Home has done over the decades, but God blimey, it looks grim in the 1970s, doesn't it? Those poor dogs just jumping up and down in cages. It's interesting to watch the kind of attitude towards dogs in this film as a whole, because I think Sam refers to Bella as she and her, doesn't he?
Mm.
But for everybody else, the dogs are it. Get it out.
Yes.
Take that out of here.
Yeah.
You know, David, when the kids adopt Battersea the dog, and take this poor dog home, there's basically the parents don't care what happens to Battersea the dog. It's just get it out. Chuck it out of here. We're not having that thing in the house. I'd like to think now that, like, you know, there would be more of a concern for that dog's welfare. what are they suggesting the kids do? Just let it loose on the street?
Well, yeah, but they let their kids.
Dare say happened. They let the
6-year-old wander the streets.
That's absolutely true. Yes. So why not let the dog do it as well? But yes, Patricia Brake, who's running the desk at Battersea Dogs Home, and the other one that I spotted was Pat Ashton, who I think is in a short scene in the nursery. But Pat Ashton went on to be the company secretary to Bill Maynard in The Gaffer, 1980s sitcom.
Right.
I can tell you're overwhelmed by that, Tyler. I can tell you're so overcome by that particular snippet of trivia, you can barely speak.
Oh, the Maynard.
Yeah, she's basically Bill Maynard's sidekick in The Gaffer, Pat Ashton.
Yeah.
Great comic actor.
Yeah. We don't have a surname. We don't discover a surname for Sam.
Oh, yes, you said you were going to come back to this.
And at first, when the film begins, you see who we presume is Sam sifting through some old ticket stubs and music hall flyers and posters, you know, from back in the day. Theatre memorabilia, if you like. My eye caught a poster advertising Sam Hall.
I saw that as well, and I wasn't sure if that was him or not.
Well, the thing is, right, he doesn't get given a surname in the film.
Yeah.
But at one point, when he's kale-eyed towards the end of the film, and he's getting very maudlin, and he sings Champagne Charlie at one point, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
But then he sings a snatch of, he sings, "My name is Samuel Hall and I hate you one and all. Blast your eyes."
Ah.
And that is an old music hall song. I think it goes under many different names and many different lyrics over the years, but Sellers performed that in 1970. There was a TV special called Wilton's, the Handsomest Hall in Town.
Right.
And it was about Spike Milligan's attempts to preserve Wilton's music hall from being demolished or pulled down.
Oh, okay.
And it was like a benefit night, and he had all his friends and showbiz come to Wilton's Music Hall in London, you know, comedians and actors and singers.
Right.
Okay. Including Spike in blackface, I'm sad to say, but there you go. But Sellers plays, Sellers comes out and does this song, The Ballad of Samuel Hall, or The Ballad of Sam Hall, and he really gives it his all. He's bellowing. It's like he's screaming at the actual audience.
Calling the policy of Wilton's, always bringing you the best in entertainment, our premier attraction tonight is Mr. G.W. Ross singing, what else would he sing but The Ballad of Sam Hall.
My name it is Samuel. My name it is Samuel. My name it is Samuel, and I hate you, one and all. You're a crowd of muckers all. Blast your eyes! I killed a man, they say, so they say. I killed a man, they say, so they say. I killed a man, they say, and in Newgate jail I lay, and the final debt must pay. Blast your eyes!
Samuel Hall, Samuel Hall. My name is Samuel Hall, Samuel Hall. My name is Samuel Hall. And I hate you one and all. I hate you one and all. Blast your eyes.
And when was this, did you say?
1970, this was.
Right, okay, TV. So it's pre-Sam.
Yes.
So another thing possibly that Sellers brought to the film himself.
Possibly,
YouTube.
Maybe,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah.
Workshopping it with Simmons.
Did that go on? He doesn't strike me as a workshopping kind of guy, Peter Sellers.
Well, no, because Simmons said that. I've got it written down here. Yes, yeah, Simmons said that whenever he put his teeth in, he was Sam.
That's right. Yeah. Yes,
and he said I'd go over the day's work with him. I'd then rehearse with the children, leaving Peter alone. The camera would be rehearsed, then Peter would come out and he'd do the scene, and that was it. He'd walk through it, no rehearsal.
Yeah. So that sounds more like the Peter Sellers that I've read about.
Yeah. And apparently, the you know, right at the end of the film where basically the kids take the remains of Bella to this Hyde Park cemetery in the dead of night without anyone realising, without Sam realising. And they bury her and they put a little sort of makeshift headstone where they bury her. And right at the end of the film, Sam goes into the little cemetery and he sees this little headstone and he looks very touched. And Liz, because Liz's dad has come and collected her and her brother, but she somehow managed to...
Now it's got dark. And you get the impression it's kind of in the early hours at some point. They finally decided it's maybe not a great idea for the kids to be wandering around the streets of London.
Yes.
But it takes until the dead of night for them to bother going to look for them.
Yeah, but then... So when Sam goes into the cemetery and sees what they've done for Bella, he looks very touched. And then they've got Liz. She follows Sam into the cemetery and they sort of look at each other. Sam's very touched by the fact that the kids have done this. Apparently, at that point in the filming, Sellers was bored with it all.
Yeah.
And he cried off sick. So they just filmed him and Liz, or the actor Donna, separately, and they just spliced it all together.
Oh, right. Okay. That's taken the edge off it a little bit, so thanks for that.
But that's Sellers all over.
Well, there's a rather bemusing story in the Roger Lewis book where it reveals that during the course of filming The Optimists of Nine Elms, Sellers was unable to get to sleep at nights unless the producer's assistant held his hand.
Yeah. Well, they've said that about Nanette Newman. She said she's had to do that in the past.
Really?
Yeah.
It's kind of... It's heartbreaking, really. That, you know, you think Sellers was 47 years old at that point and clearly behind... You know, and he did some appalling things to people in his life. There's no question about that. But stories like that just suggest a vulnerability that is so sad.
Yeah.
And again, you wonder how much of that went into Sam.
Yeah.
I hadn't watched The Optimist of Nine Elms for a long time.
Mm.
And I think this is only the second or third time I've watched it at all. But it, maybe the fact that I'm now an older, you know, I'm 50 myself, and I'm kind of beginning to appreciate that a lot of people and things in my life that I loved are no longer around. And I think I got a lot. I think it felt like more of a much more of a profound film for having watched it at the age I am when I watched it last night. I found it really, really affecting. And a lot of that comes from Sellers' performance. And yeah. I kind of, because I watched the film and then I read the extracts from Roger Lewis's book afterwards, and just found myself agreeing with him that it possibly is Sellers' finest performance on screen.
Yeah.
Having said that, I think I said the same thing when we talked about The Blockhouse.
Yeah.
So I'm just fickle.
And when you come back to talk about Where Does It Hurt next year, you'll say the same about that, won't you?
It would take a strong advocate of Sellers' talents to argue that Where Does It Hurt is his finest screen performance.
Anyway, don't worry, that's already earmarked. Someone else has already come back to talk about that.
Oh, yeah. Thank God for that. You've no idea the sense of relief I'm currently feeling. It is intriguing to speculate where Sellers' career might have gone if he had lived longer. And you kind of think he probably... Because I know he had that last flush of success with the later Pink Panther films, but he wasn't going to stay, you know, a Hollywood star for the rest of his career. And you kind of think maybe he would have come back to the UK and forged a career as a really interesting, you know, character actor on TV and film.
Yeah.
And I think I would have really liked that because. For me now, it's the low budget stuff where he often did his most interesting and his best work, and I think The Optimists of Nine Elms is a prime example of that.
I agree. It's certainly worth seeking out. It's not on YouTube, I don't think, but hopefully at some point, surely to God, someone's going to release it on Blu-ray. It deserves a nice Blu-ray release.
Surely, it's got BFI Flipside all over it,
hasn't it? Yeah.
Surely. Where are Vic Pratt and Will Fowler when we need them? Give them a call. Come on, lads. Get your act together. Where's The Optimist of Nine Elms on Blu-ray?
Aye. Yeah.
Aye. Sometimes it wasn't all as bad as all that. Sometimes. I like to finish with a song. Like all the best variety entertainers, let's finish with a song.
Well done.
There you go. You've got to pay PRS royalties to Lionel Bart now.
Bob, it's been a blast. Thanks, mate.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for asking.
Don't know exactly what we had, but there were fun times.